Good morning. This is Darrell Gunter, your host of Leadership, where we explore all facets of leadership. Today, our studio guest is Winston Lau of Winston Lau & Associates. Winston, I want to thank you for joining us this week to explore the topic of leadership and the executive mindset. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and it's a real pleasure to be here, Darrell. And thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. You know, Winston, it would be great if you can share with our audience a little bit about your background and currently what you're doing in the space of executive coaching.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. You know, Darrell, I started out in the corporate world and spent 25-plus years in virtually every capacity in, large corporations, everything from IT to manufacturing to finance, distribution, marketing, and the last 10 years of my career, actually, I was fortunate enough to be president and CEO of several companies. And so that's my background. I really knew nothing about coaching.
And how did you not stumble, but how did you make your way into coaching?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because although we have people like myself today that call ourselves coaches, as long as we work with people, we are always coaching people, or we're being coached, let's face it, you know, as part of the relationship. And it really didn't dawn on me on what I was really doing and how important it is to really help people to achieve their potentials until I became a CEO. I was CEO of a company in Canada from 1990 to 1995. And for those of you who could remember that period, 1990 was when we enacted NAFTA, you know, that's the North American Free Trade Agreement. And the essence of that agreement was within 10 years, the tariffs for a lot of the products between U.S., Canada, and Mexico would just go down to nothing. Well, what does that have to do with me? Well, I was in my company, I had three lines of businesses, and NAFTA basically destroyed two out of the three lines of businesses for me. And on top of that, if you remember back in those years, the economy was terrible in the United States as well as in Canada. So we were under a lot of pressure too. Well, the bottom line of all of that was within about two and a half years' time, I had to downsize my company 50%. I had to sell off some businesses. I had to make some acquisitions. I spent over 60% of my time either recruiting people, you know, that people I need but I don't have, or talking and try to convince, encourage, coach, do whatever it is I can to get the people that I do have to do what it is that I need them to do, but somehow they don't think they can do it, or they're not committed to doing it, or whatever. So never thought I would be doing that as a CEO, but that was really my, you know, that was really what hit home to me. And after, you know, all of that, it really made me realize what my real role is in leading people is really, you know, let's face it, we don't lead buildings, we don't lead machine tools, we lead people. You know?
Right.
So no matter what our problems were, it always ends up with getting the right people, getting them committed to what it is you have to do. You know, even as a CEO, I realized how helpless I was.
And after you were moving out of your transitioning from your one role, what motivated you to do executive coaching?
Well, early on in my career, I was fortunate enough to have taken an advanced management skills program under an individual by the name of Dr. Walter Mahler. For those of you who might have read the book called A Leadership Pipeline, the authors gave credit to Dr. Mahler, who's the one who actually developed that particular model. And so I've always, felt that I would want to be doing something like Dr. Mahler was doing, which was to, you know, help individuals to realize their potential. And secondly, in my last 10 years of my corporate life as CEOs, where I spend most of my time working with people, it really convinced me that that's where I want to contribute my time and energy for the rest of my life.
Tell us about your first experience with your first client as an executive coach. What were some of the key themes that came out of the session, and how did you help that individual to move forward in their professional career?
Well, my first client was actually a very interesting client. This particular individual was a marketing genius and a very entrepreneurial individual. And somehow he decided to get a corporate job, and he had a terrible time fitting into a corporate culture. On the one hand, they value his entrepreneurship. On the other hand, they also want him to do things certain ways, you know. And then, of course, for him, he really didn't want to do it that way. They did not, you know. So there was a lot of mismatch in culture and style and understanding what he has to offer and what the company has to have in order to succeed. So my coaching assignment was for this particular individual. Actually, I was hired by the company to work with him, was to, you know, put it mildly, straighten him out. But then shortly after we got into the assignment, I realized that it really wasn't about straightening him out. It was about helping him to understand how he can take his gift in marketing and fit into the corporate culture. So there was a lot of coaching on, you know, what would work in a corporate environment versus an entrepreneur environment, and also how he can adapt his culture. I never wanted him to totally change the way he do things, because obviously, you know, he was successful. But on the other hand, it was really an appreciation of, you know, what works within a larger organization, and also what his role was. You know, as an entrepreneur, he did everything. You know, and in an organization, well, he couldn't do everything because there were other people in place as well, and he has to value them, he has to honor them, he has to learn to lead them. You know, so it was that's what the coaching was all about.
How long did that assignment last?
Well, that one lasted quite a while, actually. Initially, it was 6 months, and then we actually went about 9 or 10 months. Mm-hmm. It was a challenging assignment. Of course, it was my first one, and secondly, it was an interesting situation. Yeah.
And what tools did you use to help motivate him, inspire him to improve?
Well, a number of tools that we used. In that particular time, we used some kind of a personality assessment to help him to understand what are some of his strengths and weaknesses and so forth. I also, you know, did a lot of interview, what we call the 360 interview. I talked to his boss, I talked to his peers, I talked to his direct reports, and try to play back to him how he impacts people. You know, it's interesting when you talk about an individual. What is an individual? Well, there's always at least two versions, if not more, of an individual. One version is the individual's perception of himself or herself. Another image is others' perception or experience of that individual. And interestingly enough, the two quite often are not the same. And when they are miles apart, that's when we have huge problems, huge problems. Because think about it, you know, we can only behave in alignment with our concept of ourselves. So if I think I'm the smartest guy in the world and I always have the right answer, guess what? I would obviously behave to that belief. You know, I would come into a meeting and offer my expertise and answers to people. Now, people may look at me and say, well, you know, this is the dumbest guy I've ever, you know, I've never worked with. But that's not my perception, and I would not know that, and therefore I would continue to behave the way I perceive myself. And that is the problem. And in this particular individual, he walked into a corporate situation with an entrepreneur background, and he was very good in what he did. But a lot of the stuff that he did would not fly in a corporation. So what we try to do is to give him that kind of a feedback and also help him to understand how his behavior impacts people. You know, another thing that's interesting in coaching, too, is that there's quite often a big difference between the intent of a behavior and the impact of a behavior. For example, most of us probably would not intentionally say something to hurt somebody, but quite often we do that unintentionally because the person who received that message interpreted differently from the way we intended. But how do we know that?
Right.
How do we know that? We don't. Mm-hmm. Right. Sometimes we may get some feedback. Sometimes we don't. And if we don't, we continue to behave that way. Guess what? At the end, we ruin a relationship. We don't get any results. We don't get the cooperation. Mm. Usually that's what we find out.
Right. You know, as a company's culture is always evolving, but there's always some clear characteristics of a company's culture. When you have a new individual that comes into that culture, they're bringing with them their characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that sometimes the company culture will embrace some of those characteristics and will evolve to a higher level so that some of the individuals success traits are now one of the main traits of the company culture?
It really depends. I would say more often than not, the company culture would tend to shape the individual to the point of actually even extinguishing that individual's, you know, contribution. Now, obviously, you know, if you bring in a person with high enough visibility, with enough power to make change, you know, like a Jack Welch in the GE, mm-hmm. obviously he was able to right. change the GE right. culture. But more often than not, you don't have that. More often than not, you're bringing an individual. And culture, you know, I'm glad you brought up culture. I would say that more often than not, an individual failed in a situation not because that individual is good or bad. It's how well that individual fits with the organization culture. I mean, organization culture is such an overwhelming thing. It is, you know, it is kind of like the human body. So what happens when you put a new heart into a human body? Well, guess what the body does? The body says, I don't like that. You know, that's a foreign object. You know, it's not me. So what does the body do? The body does everything it could to get rid of that heart. And that's what culture does.
In your experience, have you had assignments where you had a CEO to ask you to come in to evaluate the culture and make recommendations as to how they can improve their culture?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, I'm working with a CEO and COO of a company. You know, both of them were partners, started this company about 10 years ago. And they did very well. They took the company from zero to about $100 million or something like that. And they've just gotten, you know, some equity investors to come in with a large sum of money. So they went out and they make a big acquisition, one that's actually a little bigger than they were, and a company that has a very, very different culture. So all of a sudden they realize that, oops, they got a culture problem. And believe it or not, you know, culture is everything when you integrate organizations. You know, mm-hmm. it is absolutely critical. If you cannot get the culture worked out, the organization would fail. And that's really what Lou Gerstner found out when he took over IBM in 1990, I believe. He mm-hmm. ran it for 10 years. And Gerstner was a McKinsey guy, you know, great in strategy. He thought, well, gee, I can just go into IBM and, you know, and work on their strategy and redirect the company and we'll be successful. And if you read his book after he retired from IBM, he would tell you that culture was everything. Mm-hmm. It was culture. You know, he was successful in IBM because he was able to bring about the culture change in IBM. Mm-hmm. And I would say more often than not, that's the determining factor for success in businesses.
You know, going back to an earlier discussion point, you had mentioned the leadership pipeline. Mm. Tell us a little bit more about the Leadership Pipeline book and why it's important for CEOs and COOs and leaders of their companies to really understand what the leadership pipeline is and how it can help them to have long-term success.
Well, actually, it's important for everybody to understand the pipeline. What the leadership pipeline model is all about is that, you know, for most of us, we go to get an education, whatever that might be, you know, college degree, high school, trade school, whatever it is. And what we try to do at that time is to acquire some body of knowledge or some skill that would allow us to go get us a job, right? And so the first job in most cases is what we call an individual contributor, right? We are hired to do something. Hopefully we know how to do that. We have the knowledge and skills to do that. So we work hard and guess what? You know, lo and behold, in a couple of years' time, our boss come to us and say, hey, Winston, you know, you did a good job. I'm going to give you a raise and I'm give you a promotion. So now you're a group leader. You got a couple of people working for you. Well, what's the implication of that in terms of behavioral science? You know, I just got reinforced for what I've been doing as the right thing. So therefore, the implication is I better go do more of it. Right, mm-hmm. to be more successful.
Right.
So then I work harder and whatever, and guess what? You know, lo and behold, a couple of years later, I got promoted again. So now I'm the supervisor of the group. And you can see how that progression mm-hmm. goes. And most of us, that's how we would respond. And what a leadership pipeline says is there's distinctly six different crossroads, like when you cross from being an individual contributor to being a manager or supervisor, Well, it's not doing more of the same. It's not working harder. In fact, at that point, your focus changes, your scope changes, your accountability changes, and the way they measure your success changes. For example, you know, when you're managing people, you're no longer being judged for how well you can get the job done. You're being judged with how well you can build capabilities and help your people to be able to get the work done. You know, so Jack Welch says that, you know, he said when once you become a leader, it's no longer, you know, it's not no longer what you're able to accomplish that's being measured. You actually live off the reflected glory of your team's success. If your team wins, you win. I mean, think about a coach for a football team, you know. Very rarely do they say, well, you know, the team has a lousy season, but the coach did a great job.
Right.
That never happens. Right. You know, the team wins a Super Bowl, the coach gets a nice bonus and, right. you know, and That's a write-up right. in the ring and everything else.
That's right.
So at that point, you know, it really is the team yep. that you are responsible for. So in the leadership pipeline, he laid out, you know, six of these crossroads. Mm-hmm. And how the focus changes every time when you go through one of these crossroads. And you better and the real thing too is every time when your road changes, by definition, you are being asked to do something new and something differently. And by definition, you also have to learn something differently. But mm-hmm. very few of us do that, and it's not obvious to us when
right.
we do that. So that's why I think the leadership pipeline is a valuable book for anybody.
You know, it's one thing I like to point out that you said is very significant. You've been very successful, and you're promoted because of the success that you have had. And like you said, you want to go to this next level. Mm-hmm. You want to keep doing what you've been doing before, but as you realize, my job has changed.
Right.
What type of programs do you see companies putting in place to prepare folks for that transition?
It is very tough. You know, I grapple with that too, and I often wonder, well, gee, you know, why don't they teach some of that in MBA grad schools or whatever? You know, I've been to an MBA program too, and they didn't teach me that. Well, I guess what I walk away with was that not only do we have to, you know, do we have to have the opportunity to learn the new skills? We also have to have the awareness and receptivity to learn those new skills. Let me give you an example. I was an undergrad at one time, and in my freshman and sophomore year, I had to take something called microeconomics and mm-hmm. macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. And I was a teenager at the time, never worked a day in my life, and I walk into these classes, and I said, good grief, you know, These were terrible classes. They're totally theoretical, no application. I don't know why we should be required to take this. And I struggled, you know, just mm-hmm. to get by. And guess what? I, you know, got my undergraduate degree, got a job, worked for 5 years, and then went back to get my MBA at night. Well, guess what I had to do? I had to take those two exact courses again. And I said to myself, oh, my God, I can't believe I got to go through this again. And you know what? The second time around, those courses made a lot of sense to me, and I really loved them. Well, what has changed? The courses haven't changed. I have changed. You know, my experience has prepared me to appreciate what those courses are all about, mm-hmm. and I also realize I need that knowledge at the time. But how do you teach someone before they need it, before they know they need it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's not an easy thing to do. So what I walk away from is I think really a lot of that has to do with continuous learning and coaching. You know, coaching is really helping the person, you know, on a real-time basis as he or she needs it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a big part of our coaching right now, particularly with the economy the way it is, that companies are making changes a lot faster than they mm-hmm. used to. And when they put somebody into a new job, they expect that person to hit the deck and running like now, not
right.
6 months from now or 12 right. months from now. You know, that used to be the case.
Right.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the coaching work we do is what we call transition coaching. That is to help the person to learn his new role quickly and hit the deck running quickly and start producing quickly. I mean, companies are no longer willing to wait 6 months or 12 months for this person to get on board. As a matter of fact, I recently called in to coach a group president running about a $2 billion group. Mm-hmm. Six businesses under him, and he's 3 months into the job, and they already see signs of concern, and they want to get me in there quickly to either fix them or they're going to do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, they are no longer willing to wait.
And how do you get started with an individual? What are some of the key tactics that you use? Because, you know, change is not easy for everyone. For us to look in the mirror and say, I want to be better, I want to change ABC.
Well, change is not easy at all. You know, first of all, we're all creatures of habit. None of mm-hmm. us like to change. Mm-hmm. You know, even something like going to the gym is difficult. I can tell you, I struggle with that, you know. I even go as far as paying my dues every month, but getting myself to the gym, that's a whole different story. But that's change, mm-hmm. you know. So first of all, none of us like to change. Secondly, change quite often puts us in a very vulnerable position. You know, mm-hmm. we have to admit that we need to change, and nobody likes to do that, right. particularly if you're successful. Mm-hmm. What happens quite often is you really have to be experiencing a certain amount of pain before you're willing to change. For example, you're talking about, you know, being overweight, and I know we talked to many overweight people, and they will, you know, they will never want to change as long as life is good. I have a very good friend who's very overweight, but he tells me, he said, my checkup is fine, my blood pressure is fine, no need to. Well, until he got diabetes, all of a sudden he's, well, now I need to.
Right.
You know, so it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Usually with an executive, he or she would encounter a problem. And then, you know, the boss would say, hey, you got a problem, you got to do something. I don't know what you got to do. I hire you a coach, but these are the things I need you to achieve. You know, usually it's stated in terms of business results. And then we come in and say, okay, what do you have to change in order to get these business results?
Right.
And then try to help them to recognize that. So really the motivation for change to me always comes from weighing, you know, what's the difference between changing or not changing, you know?
And what should someone expect the first, let's say, 10 days of your coaching?
Well, I don't know that you can really measure anything in 10 days, I would say.
Well, not measure, but what should they expect in regards to tools or tests? Or?
Well, I would say the first 10 days, not a great deal. What I usually do is I would start with what I call a rapport-building session with the individual that I'm coaching. As a matter of fact, I'm doing one this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I go in and try to get to know the individual. Try to establish a rapport with the individual, and the rapport goes both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, and coaching is such a personal thing that chemistry is very important. Mm-hmm. And I would say it to the audience right now, you know, if you don't have the right chemistry with somebody, then that's not the right coach for you. You got to find somebody else that you can work with and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is I try to get a sense of how the individual sees the problem. And the reason for that is to really try to gauge how coachable this individual is. For example, if the individual doesn't think that he has any problems at all and is totally not open to any kind of an input, that person is probably not coachable at that point. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I know that? Well, I usually, you know, in the case of corporations, I generally get to talk to the person's boss about how he or she sees the problem. I get to talk to their organization development person or the HR partner, whoever it might be. So I get some input on other people experience this individual, and then I go talk to the individual, and then I have to make some judgment mm-hmm. as, is this individual ready for coaching?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, depending on the problems, I would recommend using various assessments. I would also then do interviews and so forth. You know, whatever we try to do is really to achieve one thing, is to bring the reality to this individual, to confront him or her against his or her own perception. You know, what I try to show the individual is this is how the world experiences you, and this is how you see yourself. We have a gap here, and for you to be successful, we have to close this gap. Now, the question then for the individual to ask is, why do I need to do that? You know, why do I need to go through the pain? Well, that's sometimes is what we call consequence management. In other words, you know, what's the difference between not doing anything versus doing something? And quite often it's the consequence of not doing something. You know, nobody has to change, mm-hmm. and I cannot make anybody change. Okay, so, you know, that person has to see some benefit for changing. Otherwise, there's no reason to change.
Right, Right. One of the favorite tools that I recall when you were my executive coach some years ago was the inventory sheet.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I had a problem of working from 6 in the morning to 12 at night. But then I would take care of all of the important stuff at the worst hour of the day, which was at 10 o'clock at night. Tell us a little bit more about this inventory sheet and why it's so significant in helping a leader to understand how they're managing their day.
Well, I think one of the things that I did for you at that time was that you were working very, very long hours, if I recall. You had a global responsibility with people in mm-hmm. different time zones and so forth. And you were very conscientious, so you wanted to take care of everything. The reality is, at your level, you know, there's no way you can do everything yourself, no matter how hard you try.
Right.
Then it really becomes a matter of priority. And I believe what I did for you was what we call in our trade shadowing. I mm-hmm. shadow you one day, which means I just follow you and observe what you did. And then I play back to you, you know, in terms of, you know, what were some of the things you did and how did you spend your time. And then it was really up to you to take a look at those things and saying, well, A, should I be doing this? Or maybe B, I should have delegated this. I really shouldn't be doing it. Or C, I have no business at all whatsoever to even have anything to do with this. And I think at that time, you know, you quickly come to the conclusion that about your third of your day, you were spending doing things that you shouldn't even be doing. And so a lot of people say, I don't have time. Well, we always have time to do the things we want to do. The real key is make sure the things we want to do are the things we need to do.
Okay. I love that box. I still use that four-corner box today, the important, urgent, not important, not urgent. And that really simplifies life for me.
Well, that's a great model, and it's something you can communicate to somebody. As a matter of fact, I owe that to the fellow who wrote a book on the 7 habits, you know.
Mm-hmm. Covey.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, a lot of us confuse the difference between important and urgent. Of course, you know, if it's something urgent, we know we got to do it right away. And the interesting thing is, you know, something that's important but not urgent, we can always do it tomorrow. And there's always a tomorrow.
You know, Winston, we are almost out of time for this segment. But if you could, you have mentioned a few books today during our discussion, but is there a book that you would like to highlight that folks who are looking to improve their leadership style could read?
Well, you know, if you remember during our conversation today, we talk about how important it is to hit the deck and running when you have a transition into a new role. And I can recommend a book called The First 90 Days. It's by Michael Watkins. And Michael Watkins came out of Harvard, and he is the world's famous authority on this whole issue of what we call transitioning. That is, when you go from one job to another. And he really, in this book, he gives a very clear roadmap as to the kinds of things that you have to do, and more importantly, the kind of learnings you have to have in order to be successful. So I would highly recommend anybody,
excellent.
To get that book.
I'm going to pick that up and read that myself. Yeah. What about a good quote to inspire our audience?
Well, you know, it's recently I was at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And I saw somebody walking around the campus with a shirt with a quote printed on it that really inspired me. And the quote was from somebody called Steve Prefontaine. I didn't know who Steve Prefontaine was.
Oh, yes.
He was a runner had a very short life. He lived from 1951 to 1975 and mm-hmm. died of a car accident.
Mm.
And he was known as, you know, as one of those that really, really pushes the limit in his running. And the quote says this. It says, to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift. So I would like to leave that with our audience to think about.
Awesome. Awesome quote. Well, Winston, it's been a real pleasure. And you're going to come back next week to share some more insights on executive leadership.
Well, I would enjoy that. And thank you very much, Darrell.